Welcome to the Heal Utah Podcast, your source for politics, culture, economics, and everything in between through an environmental lens. Cool Clothing, based here in Salt Lake City, is a product-driven apparel company with a passion for the outdoor experience. They are a group of artists, designers, and athletes who collaborate to create great products that are timeless and in constant state of evolution. Born in the mountains of Utah, their innovative designs and technical fabrics have been enhancing movement and outfitting adventures for 30 years. Find them online at cool.com, K-U-H-L.com. All right, everybody. This is Michael Shea, Heal's Senior Policy Associate, and we are back from our winter break with the Heal Podcast. And we are very lucky today to have Jason Groenewald, one of Heal's OGs, who was there at the at pretty much the very beginning, right?
That's right.
Helped grow and foster Heal into kind of the organization that it's become today. And we're happy he's here from North Carolina. And we're gonna kind of talk about Heal's history and what we're working on, and we're just really excited to have you. Thank you, Jason.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Michael. Good, happy to be here.
And so you've got this pretty cool story about how you came to Utah and how you first got involved with Heal. Why don't you just give us kind of a quick recap of how that happened?
Well, I discovered Utah when I was in college. Some really good friends and I moved out to Colorado. We were in this tiny little town outside of Durango. And one weekend, we said, well, let's check out Utah. And for all I knew, Utah could have been like Kansas. I didn't grow up watching Westerns. I didn't have really any conception. You know, Google didn't exist. You didn't just type in Utah, come up with images and get a sense. But there was this place called Canyonlands National Park. And we said, well, let's go there. So we're driving in, wanting to get to the Needles Overlook right as the sun's setting. And we pull into the parking lot, and right as the sun's about to descend, I approach the edge. And what gave way was just this expansive, breathtaking view, as far as the eye could see, of pure, unimpacted wilderness. And for me, growing up in the Midwest, surrounded by cornfields, it was the first time that I really had the experience of seeing what the land was like before man had altered it. Mm. And as I was sitting there in silence with my friends, I just had this sense of peace, of awe, and inspiration, really. And I just said to myself, you know what? I need to move back here and check this place out.
the Utah effect.
Exactly. So that's really what planted the seed. And, you know, fast forward 2 years later, I finished up school, and this time I'm driving across the country. I had this old 1986 Chevy Cavalier wagon, put the back seat down, loaded it up with my prized possessions, which were like a pair of skis. I had a $40 three-season tent I got Walmart. And then, you know, just some bags and boxes of what I owned, and I had about $500 in my pocket. Only this time, I was alone. You know, my best friend and I had talked about making the trip together. We were going to start a painting business, get set up for the summer, set ourselves up to ski in the winter. Mm-hmm. And just before the trip, as I'm about to put down some money to buy a truck and trailer with supplies, he says, you know, Jason, I'm not going to go. He's like, I really need to stay here and focus on finishing up my last year of school. And I was faced in that moment with, yeah, well, what do I do? You know, do I wait for another year and take the trip with my buddy, kind of go through with our plans just a year later? And what really pulled me forward was that experience from 2 years prior, hanging out in the desert. Mm-hmm. So there I am. I'm just, you know, heading across the country. It took a couple days, and it was right as I was coming into Parley's Canyon. I pull off at a rest stop, pull out the map, so as I come into the valley, I have a sense of where it is that I'm actually trying to go. And I was just all of a sudden filled with all this doubt. like completely second guessing my decision. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd never been to Salt Lake City. I didn't know a soul, and I didn't know what I was going to experience. And in that moment, I was also like, maybe what I should do is turn around and either go to Colorado where I'd been before, or maybe just head back home to the Midwest. Well, as I'm like kind of sitting there, I say, you know what? Let's just get through today. I found my way to Little Cottonwood Canyon right before the sun sets. You know, I get my tent set up right in the last shred of light. And the next morning, I woke up, took a little walk out of, you know, the Tanner's Flat campground. And before me was just this beautiful granite mountain face. And I said, you know what? I can at least hang out for a year. So that, you know, that was really my journey here. And those were the seeds that really connected me to this place and how special it is.
Right.
And it didn't take long. You know, one of the jobs that I got right after that was canvassing, working on environmental issues here in the state. And, you know, it was just a job to get me through the summer into the fall so I could ski that winter.
Mm-hmm.
And
Who are you canvassing for?
Well, I canvassed for a group called the PIRGS, which stands for the Public Interest Research Group. And what they did is contracted with other organizations to do membership development and fundraising. So I worked with the Sierra Club. We were doing old growth forest campaigns, worked on the Legacy Highway issue when that was here. I canvassed for the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. You know, we even did things for like the Human Rights Campaign. And what it allowed me to do is just go door to door to door throughout the valley. So from some of our more liberal pockets in the Avenues and Sugar House to some of the more really conservative areas of West Valley and Sandy and Draper. So it really gave me a sense of Utah, the people, the diversity here, the various viewpoints, and what it was like to connect with people where they were at on issues that mattered to me and, you know, developing enough rapport that, you know, it mattered to them.
Right. So you're canvassing for this environmental group. You're kind of getting to know the state. You're seeing the different people. How did you get involved with the Healthy Environmental Alliance back in its heyday?
Well, it really started with Families Against Incinerator Risk.
Right.
So
which we should mention is the sort of the original organization that he'll became or blossomed from.
Yeah, exactly. we shifted our focus from FAIR and expanded into Heal Utah, and I'll tell that story about the transition.
Yeah.
So what happened is in the fall of 1998, I went from canvassing for the PIRGS and these other organizations, and I met Lisa Puchner. Lisa was one of the co-founders of FAIR. She, along with Chip Ward, Cindy King, others, had looked at, well, I guess it was Chip and Lisa, had put together this organization because the Army was burning chemical weapons out in Tooele. And some of the very top managers at that plant had said this is one of the most unsafe operations they'd ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
Like the general manager said, this is a space shuttle Challenger waiting to happen.
Right.
And he was fired. And interestingly enough, I had discovered FAIR when I came into the Valley the year before by picking up this issue of Time magazine. And as it was featuring this article driving across the country, they did a story about Salt Lake City in Utah. And Families Against Incinerator Risk was actually featured in talking about the issues of disposing chemical weapons. So she and I happened to meet, and through that conversation, I said, well, I'd be interested in helping out. And so she brought over two manila envelopes filled with articles, newsletters, reports about all of the problems they were having at this incinerator. I went camping that weekend. I read through everything and came back down into the valley, and I was like, Lisa, what can I do to help? I was like, you know, I know how to raise money and build membership. And Mind you, these are like $25, $50 donations, right? And FAIR was an all-volunteer organization. She said, Jason, you know, to be honest, we've been talking about folding the organization. It's not what I want to do, but I took time off from family and career, and I really need to get back to that. You know, FAIR didn't have any employees, and here I am like, well, what if I was working for FAIR? And so through a couple conversations, what ultimately happened is I became the director of FAIR. We didn't have our 501c3 status. We didn't have a budget. There was no money. In fact, the bank account had been closed.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And the board had stopped meeting.
So on the ropes.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, because the incinerator had already been operating. And it was like, what are we going to do now? Mm-hmm. You know, the Army's already dumped $1 billion into this thing.
So how can we stop this?
Yeah. How are we going to stop this? And so what I did is started going door to door for FAIR in the evenings. And during the day, I was working out of my bedroom. So my bed was my desk. I took out the clothes of one dresser drawer. That was my filing cabinet. And I worked on the desktop computer of my roommate and started going to regulatory hearings. Started going to commissions, citizen advisory commission meetings, and just speaking to the concerns that we as citizens had about all of the problems that were showing up at this incinerator. Mm-hmm. So that really began my involvement and, you know, kind of, if you will, breathing life back in to the organizing efforts and the organization so that there was a watchdog paying attention mm-hmm. to the Army. Mm-hmm. So fast forward, you know, Chip Ward had written this book that came out right about this time called Canaries on the Rim. And for anyone who knows Chip, he's just an amazing advocate and organizer. And he lays out the vision of what it is that we came to work on, which is how Utah had become a dumping ground for the nation's nuclear and toxic waste. Mm. You know, the map that we would show is how Utah had two hazardous waste incinerators, one of the largest hazardous waste landfills in the country. 42% of the nation's stockpile of chemical weapons, which happened to be the largest stockpile in the world. We had the largest toxic air polluter in the country, the largest emitter of toxins to the environment. Mm-hmm. And all of this is within like a 60-mile radius. And then on top of that, we had the largest radioactive waste landfill, you know, which got created through a bribery extortion scandal with now proposals to expand and take hotter waste. And on top of that, private utilities who wanted to bring the nation's high-level nuclear waste to the Goshute Reservation. Right. So we're looking at all that, and, you know, there really weren't many people involved looking at that broader picture. And so what ended up happening to create the transition from FAIR to Heal Utah is that we did have an alliance. So there were a handful of nonprofit organizations, you know, mostly volunteer based. And we started meeting. We'd meet up at the law school, in the library. The first handful of meetings, there might have been a half a dozen people. You know, then we grew to 10. So then we found some space at the city hall, meeting in some of their conference rooms. And then that 10 grew to 20. And what we saw was that we had the seeds for a broader focus, and that's where FAIR became the Healthy Environment Alliance of Utah. And I emphasize the alliance because we really did bring collaboratively those various organizations and people together. And what we saw was that Heal Utah could be the primary driver. We were the one that had the staff. You know, me, at that time it was me, John Jensen. Over time we added others. And then we had the ability to start writing grants, mm-hmm. building a membership donor base. And it really just began to take off from there.
And so now, so, you know, Heal has, you know, been established. You've got all these groups together, and you're sort of forming this kind of core mission. What was it like, sort of, when you first ran up against kind of the Utah power structures, when you began, you know, going to these regulatory meetings, meeting with legislators, meeting with the governor's office? I mean, what was the initial reaction from sort of the powers that be?
Well, it was an interesting time. You know, Governor Mike Leavitt was in office, and he had taken a position against the disposal of high-level waste on the Goshute Reservation, but had remained painfully silent on EnviroCare's proposal to take hotter waste. Mm-hmm. So it's just such a double standard, and obvious, because for folks that don't know, what EnviroCare, now Energy Solutions, right, wanted to do was take basically everything but high-level nuclear waste. And when we got into these hotter forms that they call Class B, Class C, low-level, you got to really put it in quotes, because at these nuclear power plants, if a fuel rod were to crack and leak its contents into that pool, mm-hmm, it would get filtered out and trapped in these resins. Well, that would be Class C waste. So what was a moment before considered high level, no business going to, you know, an unlined hole in the desert,
could all of a sudden
be coming here.
And I should note for our listeners that if you do want to get more information on the differences between waste classification, all that information is on our website, and I suggest you check it out, because it really is, it can get pretty technical really quickly, but you begin to see how these lines can quickly be blurred, and it certainly demonstrates why we're sort of in this fight again with depleted uranium, where currently it's classified as Class A waste, but it gets hotter over time and eventually will become Class C or even higher. And so, I think that's certainly one of the important roles of HEAL, is being able to share and project that information to the public and be able to clarify, because oftentimes in our, as I've been working with HEAL, is the powers that be, the man, they rely on a level of complexity that the public isn't able to absorb to make their arguments. And eventually you just that, you don't understand. Oh, you this leave it to us. We'll handle it. And, that is sort of the firm foundation of why HEAL is so important, is being able to say, no, we can operate at this technical level too. And frankly, you're wrong, or you're lying. I think that gets kind of the core of what HEAL does.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, so one of the things I remember is when HEAL got involved in, stopping the disposal of and dumping of high-level nuclear waste on the Goshute Reservation, I remember there we are up at the Capitol, and Governor Leavitt had called a press conference, and he wanted to announce this broader coalition that included us as a nonprofit, some of the business groups that had come together. And as he's concluding his comments, the media had asked their questions, and then I raised my hand. And I said, Governor Leavitt, we really appreciate you taking this position. What about, EnviroCare's proposal to dump nuclear waste here? Are you also against that? And he kind of stammered. It was not what he was there for.
Right.
But that was kind of what we did, is kept the pressure on.
Right.
To say, we need a consistent policy, mm-hmm, and be the backbone for it. And that was uncomfortable for the elected officials. They did not want to have to take on that issue as well.
Right.
And that's where we stood as an organization, is like, no, we're not having any of this. Mm-hmm. And we had to keep it up in the conversation going for both. And that's really, I think, the difference that HEAL Utah does make, is, where our politicians maybe are trying to thread a needle and, pacify donors and constituencies, we don't let them get away with hypocrisy.
Right. Right. Yeah. Well, and on that note, what is that line, right? What is the line of having a press conference with the governor, all holding hands, sort of kumbaya, saying we you keep what I hear over and over again is we're doing it the Utah way. You know, we can come together and solve our problems, but, you know, there's a very fine line between, you know, collaboration and working together and greenwashing. You know, it's something for our organization that we face all the time, almost on a daily basis on, you know, what issues do we draw an absolute line, hard no, or what issues do we try to come to the table and help shape policy? I mean, what is your thought process in terms of how you evaluate those situations?
I really look to what is our core conviction and what are we standing for? You know, we're here to do this work for the benefit of this and future generations. Mm-hmm. We have a different mission than a lot of the other players in the state, you know? And so for me, one of the things that I really took away in working with Claire Geddes, who is remarkable in her effectiveness up at the Hill.
Oh, yes. Yeah. If you've never met Claire, she she can get things done.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, she joined. One of the reasons that we had as much success is because she really guided the way and what it takes to get be effective up on the Hill. And mm-hmm. so I just kind of got under her wing and did what she said, which meant like showing up at 7 in the morning as legislators are parking their cars, walking into the Capitol, walking with them to have conversations, you know, because that's when you could catch them.
Right.
Getting out in the media so that when they open their paper in the morning, our issues were on the front page and that's what they had to talk about. Mm-hmm. You know, you would ask like, well, so where is that line? One of the things that Claire said is, Jason, don't fool yourself. None of these people are your friends. Mm-hmm. You know, what you want is for them to respect you. So I think coming from a place of integrity where we're consistent in our approach, we have integrity in what we're saying and who we're being. I think that's what earns the respect. Mm-hmm. And now it's up to them to decide what side of the issue they're going to come down on.
Right.
And so if they're not taking the view, like you talked about depleted uranium, I mean, this one to me is an obvious issue. And if you're not with us, then I'm going to do what it takes to have you either not in that position or change your vote. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we talk about depleted uranium. I mean, the way that they're going about this classification is, they're saying we're going to label it at the time that it's...
Time of acceptance
versus how hot it's going to get over time.
Right.
You know, that would be the equivalent of going to a distillery and saying, we're going to sell this at the time of bottling versus the time of fermenting.
Yeah.
Right? Oh, absolutely. It's just water with some hops and barley versus beer or whiskey.
Right.
Like, but that's just absurd.
Yeah.
Right? And that's what they're doing. So to have legislators who maybe are not even giving this full attention sign off on that, that's just ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And then leaving it up to the regulatory agencies that we know have had a history of being compromised is also an absurd notion.
Right.
You know, these kind of decisions require full buy-in. And I think that's where Heal Utah comes in, is because it's like, we got to keep holding that line and keep driving home that message. Mm-hmm.
Not to mention, I mean, to sort of further sort of demonstrate the stacking of the deck is, you know, Energy Solutions is I think by far the biggest campaign contributor to the Utah legislature.
Yeah.
I think, you know, when talking to people, it's, you know, I think everybody has this sort of vision of, you know, these sort of evil legislators in their back rooms making these deals. And, you know, that's not really how it works. It's sort of this amorphous system that lends itself to these sort of little decisions that keep pushing the line further and further back. And then next thing you know, few years down the line, we're taking higher level waste. And you know, I think that demonstrates kind of the importance of holding the line, is that it's, you know, rarely are decisions made, you know, big sort of environmental catastrophe decisions made in like one foul swoop. It's little piecemeal decisions that happen over years. And you know, frankly, these corporations, Energy Solutions, knows that, and they know how to do that. And so it's just to your point of being able to hold that line and not sort of being, you know, be like, okay, we can, I guess that sort of strange regulatory structure that you're proposing, you know, it doesn't seem like too bad. And then next year that'll be changed a little bit more. And then the next year a little bit more. And so,
yeah, you know, I think going back to part of it is like, so when do we know what approach to take with a legislator? I always did like to start with the conversation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not presuming that they even have taken the time to get informed on an issue. I mean, they're dealing with a lot. And some of them are up there because their commitments are to education or their commitments are to agriculture.
Right.
It, you know, the issues that we care about and are thinking about just may not be on the radar screen.
Mm-hmm.
And so starting with a conversation to understand what their position is, have they gotten the information? So from there, I think one of the things that Heal Utah has done is looked at various ways to then influence that person. You know, and that could be either through information, it could be through media, it could be through grassroots organizing.
Mm-hmm.
It could be through coalitions, bringing groups that they're influenced by to the table and having them hear from others who they respect and trust.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because that's the other thing that companies like Energy Solutions will do. They'll cast doubt on groups like Heal Utah. Oh, you don't want to believe them.
Oh, yeah. They're crazy. They don't understand.
Yeah, they're just, you know, part of this radical left or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, we have to deal with that because the Energy Solutions of the world are manipulative and also looking at what they can do to get their agenda through and say whatever it needs. I mean, the bottom line, lest we have any other notion, this is an unlined 20-foot hole in the desert. Putting this kind of toxic, long-lived, dangerous waste in a hole in the ground and saying somehow it's safe or arguing any, that's just putting lipstick on a pig.
Yep.
I mean, this, we have no business taking these kind of wastes,
mm-hmm.
especially not here under those conditions. So that's what we're, you know, I think we always have to come back to the bottom line. And, you know, you got that shallow aquifer just a few feet below the bottom of the dump.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it's, you know, I think, you know, one of the issues that, you know, makes this, you know, especially depleted uranium hard is when you start talking about, it's, you know, deep time. You know, and you know, depleted uranium right now, like you said, is you know, we could have a piece sitting on the table and we would be fine. But over, you know, thousands of years, it becomes incredibly poisonous. And so, you know, we're not talking about protecting our children or our great-grandchildren or you know, generations to come, but we are talking about protecting this land that we all call home for, you know, hundreds of generations, and being able to convey that notion is a complex one. But I mean, that's why we do our jobs, I guess.
Yeah, and I think by doing that, what we really stand for is responsibly dealing with the problems that exist in the world today,
mm-hmm.
and not continuing to make more of them.
Right, right.
You know, everyone would always say, "Well, if you're against dumping nuclear waste here, what's your solution?" And it's like, listen, we're not just going to loosen the belt here so that you can continue to make more of this without being responsible for the fact
exactly.
that after 60, 70 years of nuclear power production, our country, despite the brightest minds, still has not come up with anything better than sticking it in a hole.
Yep.
You know, so one of the reasons that Heal Utah began the efforts to work on renewable energy development is because the way to get out in front of some of these issues is to prevent the problem from being created. So our, you know, our consistency has been, yeah, let's change the way that energy is produced so that we don't have the waste products, be they nuclear waste or CO2. You mm-hmm. know, that's just the waste of fossil fuel.
Yep.
And we can look at what's happening in our environment today and the impact on public health. And it's devastating. So we absolutely need to change and fundamentally shift the way that we generate electricity and energy in this country and in the world. And I think that's where you're also going to see consistency in Heal Utah's approach.
Mm-hmm. I do want to ask kind of one final question. And you know, that's what's it like to sort of be at the beginning of an organization that has grown and has maintained, I mean, has not only maintained its you know, influence, but grown and you know, we're up to 7 employees now, and every year we seem to grow, and you know, what's that like? I mean, it's got to be kind of cool.
Yeah, it's really remarkable. I mean, none of that was predictable when we started. You know, we were single issue focused, and then it was like, well, we've got these 5 or 6. And then it was like we really saw the need for protecting public health from the threats of nuclear and toxic waste, and also working at the intersection of public health and the environment. So I'm really proud that this organization has continued to grow. What it really reflects is not only the contributions of individuals along the way, but the community at large. I mean, we're here today because members, supporters, leaders continue to support and advance these issues and use the infrastructure that we have at HEAL Utah to get things done. And we just completed the work of a generation. And we're now taking the next step for the next generation. Mm. And, you know, we just had our fundraising breakfast where Sandra Steingraber said, you know, listen, folks, by the middle of the century, scientists predict that there may not be fish in the ocean because the whole system is going to collapse. Mm. And that is so shocking. And she went on to say, and if we don't radically reduce CO2 emissions in the next 11 years by 2030, like, that's the inevitable outcome. You know, the time is really now. And we have the benefit of people that have been working together, know how to get things done. And so for me, what's great about it is that we can immediately get to work and spend less of the time building out the infrastructure and more of the time flexing the muscle of the infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jason, thank you so much for coming on the podcast, and we hope you come back to Salt Lake soon.
Well, thanks, Michael. It's been great to be here, and I'm really appreciative of your work, everyone at HEAL, and again, just how the organization continues to stand at the forefront of what matters to our lives and the lives of future generations.
Excellent. Well, thanks again, Jason. This is Michael Shea, and as always, thank you so much for listening. Thanks for listening and supporting the HEAL Utah podcast. Join us next time where we will keep looking at politics, culture, economics, and everything in between through an environmental lens.